Good evening, or morning, wherever you are. This is the second episode of Unfrozen, the Architecture and Urbanism podcast. I'm Dan Zafarik, and this is Greg Lindsay.
Hello, Daniel.
Greg, where are we?
We're in Venezia for episode two, just like we were last time, for those of you who are joining us. But now we have spent two entire days going to the Biennale, and I am all Biennale'd out. But we have lots of thoughts, months after everyone else did, about highlights, lowlights, and what it all means. How will we live together, Dan? That is, of course, the theme.
Well, apparently there's a number of iterations that that could take. Some of it involves being placed into a cage, a sort of a boombox terrarium that resembles the first landfall of the transatlantic cable in Ireland. I believe it is meant to be a satire of the extreme toll that the data-centric existence that we live takes on the environment and perhaps on our psyches as well. I thought that was one of the more interesting pavilions, just starting with that.
Well, it was, although I would say the theme of that, as your description underscores, this was an architecture biennale that I felt did not have a lot of architecture in it. There was a lot of dancing about architecture, not a lot of dancing, I guess, per se, but you know the phrase, but a lot of art about architecture. But before we get too deep into the weeds there, where should we begin? I think we should start in the Giardini, perhaps. That was day one of our thing. And for those of you who don't know the Biennale this year, the way it works is there's a curator. The curator has a central exhibition. This year it's Hashim Sarkis, who's the dean of MIT's architecture school. He like took the whole universe and broke it up into five scales of how we will live together, from individuals up to like the planet. And so he broke that up across two sites. And then all the nations that are part of the Biennale have their own pavilions where they do their own thing that might work with the theme, that might not. And yeah, just one quick observation at the top, despite the fact that this Biennale is opening a year late, had to reset the whole thing, only a handful of pavilions even referred to the pandemic. It's kind of 2019 here again, which is, good and bad in a way. But I guess 2023 will be the pandemic Biennale running behind the times. So
yeah, it was interesting to see that there was quite a bit of acknowledgement of issues that I suppose were already coming to the fore prior to the outset of the exhibition, but things like social strife and inequality, and obviously are persistent issues, so it wasn't like those were new issues for 2020. It's just that they turn into conflagrations in 2020 in ways that I don't think a lot of people anticipated, but that had the effect of making those exhibitions that did address those issues seem very prescient and on point. Although again, as you say, mostly from the perspective of a social critique, but not necessarily a built solution or built proposed solution.
Indeed. Well, I would say a social critique, in a place that sells Aperol spritzes on demand and, is still, of course, as we discussed last time, part of the global curatorial elite, where Rolex is the lead sponsor. First place we visited in the Giardini was the Rolex Pavilion, which, to its credit, really nailed it. Had a young architect that's, building a school in Niger and working with Sir David Ajaye and part of the whole program. I was all ready to mock Rolex, but the crown beat me to it. So there's that. But let's talk about the Giardini, because of course, like everything else in the film competition, everything else, it's a competition. There was a Golden Lion reward. We'll tell viewers, listeners at the end here who actually won. But podium finishes, Dan. Who are your top three national pavilions? And then perhaps we can get into some of the other honorable mentions and lowlights. But
right,
where do you land here?
Well, we're talking about individual pavilions as opposed to dedicated country rooms in the Arsenale, which is also kind of
those are also
a separate
pavilions.
Track.
No,
that
those
counts
are
as a pavilion.
That counts as a pavilion.
Okay, because I think of them in terms of their individual, folly-like architecture as a total package.
That's true, but the winner of the Golden Lion was one of those, tucked inside a room here. So you're still in competition. So top three.
All right, so top three in that category. Well, I mean, if you start with the best combination of the use of space and the fact that it, I think, is the best architecture as a building, is probably the Nordics Pavilion. They had a very creative use of, well, first of all, let me describe it a little bit for those of you that don't know it. It represents the three Nordic countries, the Sweden, Norway, and not Denmark.
It is Finland. Finland has its own pavilion, but Finland's there too.
Yeah, that's true. That's confusing. And it's a beautiful high modernist building, which has concrete beams that are set on a very narrow interval with kind of a plastic covering over the top that admits light down into it. And then through the center, some mature trees are growing up. So it has a very sort of organic feel already. And then, of course, being Scandinavians, you know, they filled it with wood. And it basically, they asked you to take your shoes off and to walk around and kind of feel the communal, you know, blonde wood good vibes that they've been putting out for decades now. But, you know, it's just because it's something that is almost a cliche at this point, it doesn't mean that it doesn't work. It is a cliche because it works.
It works extremely well. So it's Helen and Nord, the firm, has actually created a co-housing space inside of there. No one's actually living there, which we'll come back to in a second here, of like where this Biennale should have gone, I frankly think, with a lot of these pavilions, for how we will live together is the theme. But they actually created a co-housing space. And like, yeah, our both of our takeaways was, I would like to live here, please. How do I get a residency at the Nordic Pavilion? Which is kind of a theme for some of the other ones as well. So I think that's both the podium finish for us. We'll figure out our top three here. But who else is in your top three?
Okay. And then I do think that the Japan Pavilion was pretty great in the way that it not only made use of its space, which is kind of a convoluted path, perhaps a little more convoluted than it normally would be because of COVID restrictions on how you have to enter and exit. But basically, you almost circumnavigate the whole place inside and out on two different levels. And it's pretty much an open air pavilion. There's almost no conditioned space in it, just maybe at the very top. And what they've done is they've broken down for this year's exhibition, a typical Japanese house that was constructed in the mid 50s. And as some of you may know, there's kind of an interesting building culture in Japan where basically a site could be maintained for centuries, eons, and, you know, there could be a deliberate deconstruction of that site where I'm talking about, you know, ancient temples. It's like a ritualistic thing that's done out with the old, in with the new, but in the exact same place and on the more or less the same principles. And they sort of applied that to their post-war housing regime as well. So we have this deconstructed house, and keeping in spirit with that, you know, there's kind of a cycle of life happening here. They deconstructed it, moved it in through shipping containers to Venice, and laid out all the pieces with QR codes attached to them, RFID identification. They know where all the parts came from and where they were placed in the house. And then they started converting them individual pieces. They kind of chewed away at the tail end of the exhibition by creating objet that they were actually selling to Biennale attendees, including me.
This is where I have to acknowledge here that, you know, Japan is my personal golden line here, because so first off, to your point there about the whole culture of reverence in Japan for like sites but not buildings, like we went to the Hotel Okura before they tore it down in 2015, Dan and I, and like, despite the fact that like that lobby, like, you know, perfect modernism, and like basically like the smoke was so impermeated, everything was like almost like you could just like cut slices out of the air. It was incredible. And the Japanese tore it down without a second thought, despite Tyler Belay and other luminaries being like, don't do it, don't do it. And they built it back exactly the same and better in their minds. This is so Japanese, and I find it utterly fascinating. Like, no culture preservation. Rem Koolhaas would approve.
yes.
But in the case of the house, yeah, you know, I mean, you know, wonderful concept, you know, taking apart this just totally ordinary house. I mean, I think my favorite was, there was just a panel off a door that still had the children's Disney princess calendar pinned to it, just as it was in 2019 when they disassembled the house. It was that raw in a way. And yeah, and like, listeners, you know, this is where I confess that I went downstairs and like we started to see like where like random Italian artisans that they had subcontracted for this, which we'll come back to in a second, had started building out furniture. And yeah, and you know, and you know, my wife is Sophie Donaldson, who was the editor of House Beautiful magazine, who believes utterly in like the essence of home and what home represents. And so this idea, this powerful idea that, you know, that you could take a piece of a house that has been recombined in a classically and stereotypically, honestly, Japanese style into something maybe greater than the sum of its parts or outliving the sum of its parts, and that you could bring it into your own house, like on the spot, like bought a bench. And there were also a couple of American hipsters who were like trying to outbid me, which is the surly side of this, because you know, devolved into a real gift shop element here, because with my purchase of my bench that is composed of, I don't know, maybe like a ceiling joist and then like some wooden laminate floor tile. I mean, it's cool. It's signed. Like Walter Benjamin is like frowning upon me right now. And, you know, it'll hold some books in my office. But with that purchase came literally a block of wood with a handle attached to it, which for €5 was what they were selling it for. So I got a €5 bonus. And like, yeah, there's a real sort of gift shop aspect to the Japanese pavilion, which frankly has always been part of my thinking of like, why are the other countries, especially Venezuela, which was closed this year, just literally not selling things out the door? Like, you know, and I say this because I went to Expo 2010 in Shanghai, and that's basically what the North Koreans were doing at the time. I bought a stamp collection from them then.
So, of current stamps.
Right. Yeah, I had the deer leader, Kim Jong Il at the time. So I believe the deer leader. Anyway, so that's Japan there. And so, yeah, so the fact that I could take home a piece of the Japan pavilion, you know, can't walk away from that deal. So definitely Golden Lion has nothing to do with the fact that they took my money. And oh, and I mentioned, you know, the person who took my money was a very handsome young Italian sculptor named Valentino. And shout out to Valentino there for hiking that over and passing me my shrink wrap passage. Let us pray that it survives the flight home.
Yes.
All right, rounding out your top three, Dan. What finishes also on the podium? We're both in agreement so far. Nordics, Japan, who else?
So then this sort of, you know, if the golden standard is, you know, best integration of pavilion architecture with an architecturally themed display that is, you know, syncretic with it somehow, I'm going to diverge from that just because of what it had to say. I really liked the Austria Pavilion.
Ooh, good choice. Just missed my podium. But yes, what about the Austrian Pavilion?
So the Austria Pavilion decided to gather some contemporary thinkers. I think Leo Hollis was in there.
Shout out to Leo.
I think there was the gentleman who has made all the, no, I'm forgetting his name, Liam something, who's made all the dystopian films.
I don't think there was a Liam Young in there, but maybe I not that. Liam Young. But so many good people. Alan Wigg, Alan, if you're listening,
Saskia there.
Saskia Assassin, Richard Sennett, a whole lineup of everybody who's been critical about
David Harvey,
urbanism.
I think.
David Harvey, Jathan Sadowski, who's out there writing about this stuff. I had the most intense FOMO at the Austrian Pavilion because literally my entire Twitter feed was basically on the walls there. So
the platform is my boyfriend was the title of one half of the exhibition. And basically it was this idea of, you know, in a world where we're just now completely enslaved to these online platforms and online identities, is there any room left to create identities or live in spaces that we physically create that we don't have to share with everyone? At least I think that was the proposition.
Well, there was that. I really enjoyed the Austrian Pavilion was the, what is it, the CCA, I forget exactly the acronym, but they basically built out a typology of platform urbanism.
Oh, yes.
Archetypes. And it was basically everything you think of like late capitalism here, of like, you know, co-working spaces and isolation pods and green roofs and DIY furniture. And of course, the whole point of it is that, like, basically the Jane Jacobs and the entire urbanist project has been completely co-opted by all forms of capitalism, and that everything you think is your awesome DIY tactical placemaking urbanism thing is completely in the service of capital. And the Austrians said the quiet part loud. That was the great thing about their pavilion.
Yeah, it was very unsubtle, you know, and which I understand is kind of the Austrian way. So maybe we shouldn't be so surprised.
That was good. Well, I will diverge you there. My third place. Yeah, I guess we're going to put it into bronze here. It was actually the Korean Pavilion, former Golden Lion winners under Min Suk Cho in 2014, and they're always great. But they did the thing that I thought all the pavilions should have done for how we will live together, which is they sort of turned their pavilion into an ongoing education platform and just move people through. When we were there, there was students and teams. They were using the space. As a non-architect myself, I always think about like ways of utilizing or ways of activating these spaces, and like they just turn it into a place to host workshops and thinking about all the different aspects of how we will live together. And that sounds kind of basic, but yet no one else did it or turned it into a sort of a living thing. And I think of that expressly during the COVID year, where, like, you know, in May, things were great when the press preview happened, and then things have gotten progressively worse. But the Koreans were doing great workshops in August and elsewhere, and you know, pushing through the Delta variant to get this, you know, to get these projects out there. And so their pavilion's covered in ongoing printouts and sheets of all the ideas they're continuing to develop. And I thought that was really strong. So yes, that'll be my bronze. But any other highlights? You called out the Ireland pavilion, definitely a piece de resistance of, like, exhibition design with their, you know, server racks covered in bric-a-brac and fans. It definitely had a feeling of, like, a post-apocalyptic or I don't know, some sort of Fall of Man thing there. Any other national pavilion callouts?
Yeah, for the national pavilions, I did like the Turkish pavilion that was on the second floor of, I think, what's just called Building A.
Extremely yellow.
It was very, very yellow, but it was kind of like, I guess the proposition there was like, we're some kind of future society and we're looking back on all of the stupid things that humanity was doing and thought was important in a couple of different modules, one of which was an old mine, and another one was a logistics center, which had been repurposed to store kind of like a Noah's Ark of about to be extinct or would have been extinct species had they not taken these precautions to store them in the logistics center. So it was kind of dystopian. And the yellow color kind of gave it a sort of bright yellow vest, you know, warning sign kind of aspect that was, you know, a little bit unsubtle, but then again, these are unsubtle times.
Well, it just underscores the thought I had through a lot of the Biennale, which is, I don't know, again, as an outsider in this, is like, I want to know, like, where do you learn exhibition design? Like, there's a whole thing here that I would love to hear from listeners of, like, just the conceptually of, like, here's a space, what can we build in it? What do we have budgets? What do we have support of? Like, I don't know, the instrumentalist in me and the materialist in me is always sort of interested of, like, the actual processes that get these pavilions built. Because, like, yeah, the Turkish one had some thinking under it, but also, like, who's had the great idea to just, like, paint the entire thing this blinding yellow, which was so effective, and there you go. And this, of course, is part of the greater, you know, Biennale industrial arts complex there too. But I thought I had both days wandering through these pavilions, but, like, you know, like, how do you learn to be a curator, and how do you learn to do exhibition design? And I say that even as being part of a team here, which we'll come to when we get to the main exhibition there. But yeah, any other shout outs before I give a few of mine?
No, I think I'll let you have the stage for a moment while I collect my thoughts.
Yeah, let's see. So a couple of call outs. I mean, big strong one for me, the Philippines Pavilion, which was just, they basically built a library in Bulacan, but they did a sort of call and response to the audience where people could submit to an online form and they would print out and hang examples of mutual aid and mutualism. And so, you know, this notion of how we will live together and how we will support each other. The Philippines has such a great, simple and powerful idea. And so big shout out to them. Really like Singapore Pavilion as well, which sort of addressed various themes of housing and the night markets. And we were discussing earlier, like, the sort of Philippines or the Singapore Pavilion, while others are like, these are imaginaries. We have, you know, we hope these utopian things will be realized. And Singapore's sort of like, yeah, we got this. Like, we're sort of doing this stuff already.
Yeah.
So very, very practical there. But yeah, those were highlights for me. I would say the Philippines Pavilion was part of Curators Cooperative, which was a whole effort this year, among 50 of the National Pavilion curators to sort of coordinate. And there was a good one, Albania, sort of showing about the importance of neighbors, resonated with me because I was just there before this in Tirana, and heard a lot of that discussion. And also, you know, Slovenia and some others. Also, quick two highlights. I really liked, and this was a resonant theme for me, the national pavilions that were thinking a lot about shrinking and degrowth. And that includes, Romania was thinking about this. Poland was sort of thinking about this.
Estonia.
Maybe it was Estonia was thinking hard about this. That was it. I knew it was one of the Baltics. You know, there were three or four countries that were thinking hard about this. And then this is the whole conceptual problem I have with, like, climate migration right now, is that you then had, you know, a whole other theme of the Biennale thinking through about climate emergency and climate disasters and migrants, and no one's putting those two together, because that is a very scary idea that we will repopulate those shrinking cities with migrants from somewhere else. Sort of an unspoken theme in the Biennale, but I picked up on those sort of mournful notes of those, you know, multiple national entries being like, what do we do with these shrinking cities and how do we activate them?
Did you see the Romanian pavilion?
I did, and that was a really strong one to me.
Because that one really, that wasn't just about how cities in Romania were shrinking, although it was about that. That was one half. The other half was basically a couple who decided to I hesitate to, you know, correlate this to van life because of its implications, but that's basically what they did. They caravanned around Spain and, you know, the wealthier parts of Western Europe, and kind of documented the experiences of Romanian expatriates who had taken these jobs.
Well, that was it. I mean, like, Romania, the cities are shrinking because it's had its own diaspora already, and it was basically trying to document the problems of their own diaspora. So, you know, you can sort of see, like, you know, before, you know, migrants from the global south moved to Germany, everybody else's. And this was a theme that, well, again, I was in Toronto last week, and the fact that, like, they've taken in 3,000 Afghan refugees, which, if you prorated that to the size of the United States, it would be like 500,000 refugees. And yeah, and they were basically saying, like, no one wants to stay here. We're just a waypoint on the way to Germany, kind of thing. So,
and yet they're exceptionally kind to them, accommodating, putting them up in what were supposed to have been luxury hotels along the Adriatic. Yeah.
The Albanians are. Yes. You know, Albania's a, you know, a fascinating country. It's a bit of a sideline here. I do like their pavilion, but NATO members, very pro-American and very willing to take them on. So it was interesting. All right. Well, that covers it for the national pavilion. Unless you have other sort of meta thoughts, let's move to the international exhibition. And again, listeners, I assume you don't know the complete intricacies of the Biennale. So Hashim Sarkis had this plan for this year, which I thought was really sound. This is my meta commentary on the Biennale in a moment, which was to take this question of how we live together and do it in five scales. So pardon me, I don't have the catalog in front of me, but it's like as diverse bodies, individuals, as households, looking at elements of the house, as emergent communities, so looking at neighborhood scale, and then you get to across borders, and then as one planet. And so this, you know, cue Charles and Ray Ames and the long zoom out there. Hmm. All right, so perhaps we should try to take this in scale. So Dan, any thoughts on the first scale? I would say as diverse beings, a little bit, we're just getting our bearings there, and it's a little foggy for me.
Yeah, the you know, you come right in the door, you know, of the I believe it's called the cordery, which is the very, very long.
Where they bound the ropes, folks, like literally just build the longest building you can to stretch out those ropes and twine them together. It's pretty crazy.
But you come right in and you know, you're confronted by these, you know, I call them grotesques in the sense that, you know, Sherwood Anderson called them grotesques, and that not all of them are like repulsive, but they're all kind of like allegorical types. And you know, you have people who are being eaten away by birds or creatures. You have people who are kind of halfway through a door and kind of seeming like they're maybe getting shredded in the door. Like maybe that's a metaphor for crossing borders or something like that. But it looks at people at the human scale. And you kind of have to go around it in order to get to the rest of the exhibition. So you sort of can't not confront it, which I thought was bold. In this, sort of seeing this as artwork, it was bold. You know, like as architecture, I don't know that it asked or answered any questions.
That's sort of my point. A lot of this got into like it was not a lot of architecture in the Arsenal in the first three scales, but.
But there were definitely a few things where I walked into the room and I was like, this is cool. You know, just, I don't even care what this is about. Like this, like, you know, there's a robot arm that's going over a landscape. There's, you know, the floating, what was it? A number of people took to suspending rocks, or they were suspending, you know, like a 3D sort of axonometric diagram of a condition right in the center of the space. So you really had to, you couldn't really pass it up. I mean, it's kind of a tripartite space where you have columns down the two rows of columns down the center. And so it's easily dividable into threes. And there were a lot of exhibitions that violated that center space as a hallway that you could just walk down. So, you know, I don't know if that was just advantageous because the curator said, okay, fine. Or if they have to push to have that, that application or what?
Again,
lots
of thoughts on the presentation design. Yeah. As Ollie Wainwright, the architecture critic, pointed out, like on Instagram during the preview, like lots of rocks in this year's Biennale.
I mean, that would be, you know, my superficial reaction was the same, you know, moon rocks, you know, rock. There was a whole exhibit about exploring the moon, or not just exploring the moon, but settling on the moon, which
SOM gonna SOM.
Yeah, that made me a little bit sad. I mean, like, you know, that was kind of like
really well produced. It was like you could see SOM bringing it. And yes, it had triumphant music. This was in the third scale there, but like, you know, shout out to Colin Coop, who worked on that one. Really well done, but also like really a moon base. I don't know. I'm not feeling the moon right now.
And the same language, you know, was being used to talk about the solution. It's like, it's really, you know, a communal space that has, you know, divisible options. And it's like, yeah, you're going to need them if you're living on the fucking moon, you know, like.
It was, I read that entire thing as like, I was like, Elon, call me, like making the call me sign.
Kind of, yeah.
There was that one. But that was in the third scale. I would say the first scale, you know, Nick DeMonchot, who's now at MIT Architecture, you know, because this is all, you know, if you want meta inside baseball, lots of MIT throughout this entire thing, because again, Shame Sarkis, dean of MIT, but Nick DeMonchot had some of the spacesuit gloves from Apollo, sort of commentary on like the incredible thinness between the human scale and touching the void of space. That was there. I'd say when it comes to households, this is where it all starts to blur together here without reference to catalogs in front of you. But I guess I'll sort of skip around and some other highlights for me. There was one, I can't remember the team, that was very much a sort of old school shout out to like rethink capitalism and blow it all up and just had wonderful banners and like, you know, direct, you mentioned David Harvey, but like direct call out to David Harvey. And again, the my inner capitalist thought like, oh, that banner would look great on a t-shirt that are like, remake the city and remake ourselves. I'm like,
very strong.
Just hand out those t-shirts, folks. Where's my tote bag that has that on that? You know, sell it for 15 euros like the Biennale does there. They're excellent, well-stocked gift shops, I should add. That was a highlight there as well. And there were some of the folks rethinking the New York plan. The things I highlighted there was like, you know, it was a very simple exhibit, but just thinking about like, you know, I tend towards the practical. I want to think about like who has ideas on the ground that I can scoop up at the Biennale, that I can think about like who we're going to collaborate with and do that. And so therefore I tended towards the ones who are really thinking like the schematics of like how we put together housing and multifamily housing. And we're exploring that. And so there was a group, I forget, at GSAP at Columbia, that's been working on this and revising the 1901 tenement plan, the new plan, and coming up with a new plan. And yeah, efforts like that stood out for me versus some of the more theoretical. Maybe the most beautiful thing I saw in the Arsenale was Superflux's Refuge for Resurgence, which gets called out, which was their tablescape for the wild species that come to dine after humans have basically wiped themselves out on the planet and the planet is rejoining itself. Again, I don't know what it has to do with architecture, but it was awesome. Like all Superflux projects are awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think the ones that went all the way with using the space as a provocation is definitely, you know, that ranks higher than places that just showed you a bunch of renderings or, God forbid, took the entire pavilion and just gave you a QR code and say, we went virtual, which is, shout out to
the Germans and the Canadians. Yep. No honorable mentions for you guys.
Yeah. That was hard to like. That was a little rough.
Well, staying in the international expedition, I want to give a shout out, especially to, there was a great section on fabrication technologies, which I really enjoyed. Depending how deep you are in the weeds, some of it might have been good. Some of it might have been already known. There was a great shout out to ETH Zurich and the work they've done there with like robotic assembly of steel rebar and some of the great stuff they've done with 3D printed concrete and, you know, and wood frame robotic assembly and how you bring it all together. And they got a big chunk of real estate in the Arsenale. And I thought it was great to highlight it because, you know, it's still in the lab, but like those are the kinds of techniques that we need to get out of it. There was a fascinating use of glass and carbon fibers there to actually create frames there and build an actual two-story structure. Very H.R. Geiger-esque in the aesthetic, or maybe that's just me, like just seeing like, it felt like tendons. Like what if you built a house out of tendons or something like this?
Right. And it was specifically because of their tension properties that they decided to build that way. And I guess one of the reasons that it has that look is because in order to give it that tensile strength, you have to tension it, right? So they had it wrapped around metal bolts. And so it was almost like a spider's web or like really tightly pulled shoelaces formed the wall planes. It wasn't super clear, like if you wanted to enclose it, how you would actually do that. Maybe use conventional materials. Maybe you could use carbon materials from another type of nozzle. I know I learned a lot about nozzles and how to build these things from a previous book that I did for my day job with some colleagues here in Venice did the primary research for that. And I tried to edit that into a sensible document. But
it says a lot about architecture these days that nozzles play a big role into it. But there you go.
They apparently do. And, you know, certainly ABB is one of the big manufacturers. KUKA Robots also has a pretty big hand in this. You know, obviously the Boston Dynamics jumping bots, jumping, singing, dancing, and, you know, probably taking over your city bots.
Hunt you down.
In the next, you know, iteration of Hunger Games that the corporate overlords can organize, you know, get all the headlines. But I do think it is these robots that basically slowly squeeze out building materials like toothpaste that are probably going to make the initial difference in the robotic labor revolution in construction.
No, absolutely. I was in the New York Times, ran a story while we're here on, you know, on New Story and Icon and their 3D printed homes in Mexico. So that one's happening there. But yeah, other thoughts from the Arsenale, which was the first three scales. Let's see. I did enjoy that, like, at one point, you know, you cross through most of the theatrics and, like, you know, you reach the sort of section at the very end of like here's some of the big names we need to put there. And so, like, Kent Larson's got a whole thing on, oh, I forget. Was it Rahul Mohitra's got a whole thing on India, and Kent Larson's got a whole thing from various different geographies. And I like how they sort of put at the end of, like, the whole notion of, like, we've got to place these people somewhere, and so let's put them into a slot. And so they did that with them. And also shout out to Rainer de Graaf and OMA, which basically put out a video of, like, Hospital of the Future. I'm not sure how we live together, but, you know, nice production design with the hospital beds. I wish I could have lied down in one. Very annoying, all the signs. It just warned me not to sit on anything that looked remotely inviting, because this is the COVID Biennale.
Right.
But moving on back to the Giardini, which is where the two higher scales were. That's where some of, like, the really sort of, like, I think, you know, provocative, scary production design came in. My favorite piece overall of the International Expedition, just from a scary standpoint, was the exhibit that was trying to replicate the dangers of melting Arctic ice, and did so by basically inflating an aluminum set of chambers so that it made loud bangs every about 5 seconds. That worked. It was effective, cheap but effective. That's what I think of it for, you know, exhibitions.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of these exhibitions were not cheap. So, you know,
cheap scares, cheap tricks,
extra score points. Yeah, like the, air piston operated gorilla that was at Kiddyland back in the 80s in the suburban Chicago, that I was like, that thing's not scary. I mean, what's scary is that I think that thing's going to break while we're in here, along with the rest of the ride.
Well, that was the possibility at the Biennale as well, that things would break.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And thinking about, you know, spooky machines, I also liked, now I'm going to forget what the title of it actually was, but there was a pavilion that had, it was one of the national pavilions, but within the Arsenale, that had a system of sort of, again, Geiger-esque tubes, you know, but which had lights fixed to the end of them and all were sort of focused on you. So it's almost like you were walking through a car wash, like the part where the car wash blows the hot air on the car to dry it. But instead it would just shine light on you. And it was like, this robot recognizes you. Everything's fine. It's not scary.
I think that's the part where I went out to have a spritz. Although you mentioned that, I would say a special, like, you know, non-honorable mention to the UK Pavilion, Garden of Privatized Delights, which was their sort of notion of, like, how can we rethink privatized public space for more things? Well, we can rethink it all we want, but, like, really it's a question of political will. But I thought it was a really downer. And this is what happens when you go to the pavilion, like, you go to the at Biennale late in the season as opposed to, like, preview week, is that, you know, there was a session on, like, how can we rethink facial recognition and other tracking as tools of social use? And you have Keir Starmer, the head of labor, proposing that they create a new neighborhood watch and have Amazon Ring run the whole thing. So
that's terrifying.
Sorry, we're like, you know, it's a little sad that you can watch the Biennale not even be over and have reality overtake it. But that's always the problem with these things, especially when you plan it for 2 years.
Right. I mean, you know, and it was a very English response in some ways. How do we cope?
How do we muddle through?
Well, we go to the pub, of course.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, understandably, Britons were very put out about the fact that they couldn't go to the pub. It was the first closure for any reason, a national closure that had ever occurred. So there was some celebration of that. Although, you know, and of course it's pubs and gardens, you know, because England, but it definitely, the color palette was kind of weird. There was a lot of pink and it had this sort of like, it was also like Wallace and Gromit designed it, kind of like it had this sort of claymation aspect to it, which I guess was supposed to be playful, but it also sort of felt a little tossed off.
Indeed. Well, there's that. I mean, going back to the, you know, the main exhibition. I mean, the thing that I focused on, or that I was interested in, is like, who has actual, this is, again, I'm the non-architect, and so therefore I'm not interested in speaking to other architects. So to me, it's a question of who had practical solutions? How will we live together and who had it? And there were some good ones. I mean, the one that made me feel the most elated and downfall at the same time was like a great analysis of like how social housing works in Zurich, which, you know, I knew the Swiss model, Bremenpunkt, I believe was the one they called out there. And it was awesome. And also like, how do we be more like Switzerland? And how do we have these mechanisms in place? That was a really good one. It was sort of in the same vein as the one I called out earlier that was like, oh, like how do we completely decommodify everything overnight? I had great schematics and I took photos of it and I walked away being like, okay, like here's a plan. Like, let's implement the plan. And yeah, I was interested in those. There were some other, you know, great forms. Again, wish we had the catalog here and wish we weren't, you know, having a beer while we were doing this. But if we had the catalog, I could point to the great group that like basically came up with 35 different configurations and built models of ways to create new commons out of sort of private space. That was really good. And again, I like the attempts to sort of iterate, like what other forms can we build here? And of course, this goes back to like, you know, again, I think we covered this last time, but quickly here, my great complaint about the Biennale is like, where are the clients? Like,
right.
If you are the architecture profession and you are having a giant party every 2 years in May in Venice, how are you not bringing your clients here to be like, look what we can do for you if you believe in us a little bit more? And I don't know, they leave that on the table.
Well, I've used the word provocation as a kind of a
as a crutch, a like pronoun, the rest of the profession.
I don't know what to call it. Yeah, because I did like the things that were thought provoking, but if you wanted to bring your big money clients in, maybe they wouldn't want to see you spending money that they didn't give it to you directly, but you know, they wouldn't want to see you spending money on, you know, capitalism bad, you know?
Well, that's my point. Not even just the capitalism bad. I bet that gives them a thrill. Like that sort of thing, you know, when you can't actually be hurt by the Biennale, it can be fun. I think more the notion of it is that the architects would rather write in jargon to each other rather than like produce exhibits that would actually have clear lines of thinking on this. Like, I think it would be more appealing to the public if they didn't fall back into the jargon, which is taught to them from architecture school onward.
You're right. I mean, I think there are two structural problems with architecture, at least. And one of them is the fact that it's a lot of architects want to perform for each other, and they use a certain language of clicks and whirs that, you know, allows us to identify them as advanced species. You know, like, you know, we know that dolphins are really smart, but we can't really understand what they're saying to each other. And we like to watch them jump, you know. But, you know, there's also the other aspect of it of, okay, you wouldn't want to be accused of being a sellout to corporate interests or commodification, or you probably wouldn't have an exhibit. But is there no middle ground? Is there not a middle ground that can speak directly to the end user?
Well, that's a good question. There should be a middle ground, and that is a problem with architecture there. I was going to say, like, yes. I mean, the best comment was one of your colleagues when we were having spritzes last night pointed out that like what I was talking about was MIPIM, which is the giant property fair in Cannes, where like they all go, everyone goes to Cannes and gets right. wasted in Cannes, and developers show off their mega projects. Should architects go to Cannes? Yes. Architects should go to Cannes and hang out with their clients there, and then should bring the clients to Venice and be like, here's what we can do if we push this a little bit further than your, you know, selling off the plan kind of stuff. So yeah, I think it's a push-pull dynamic. Should there be an actual fair to lay people on this? I mean, let me pull up the ghost of Tom Wolfe here from our house to Bauhaus, and he would tell you yes, and he would probably like stand up for this. And yeah, I mean, obviously architects should push that further. So yeah, that's the thing. Like the Biennale, like well attended. We've been here for two glorious days in the Giardini and the Arsenale, and great attendance there. But yeah, I mean, it raises the question of like, who is this ultimately for? Going back to like skepticism, like why we even continue this? So I don't know. I mean, I loved it. I'm in it. I'm in the Biennale. I got to take a photo of myself with my station. Thanks to Rafi and Sarah and Marissa for putting that together while I was trapped in quarantine in Canada. And it was actually, I think, some of the clear communication we had there, like great interviews and video mm-hmm. and talking about it. But yeah, we, you know, we need to do more to reach people, and that's part of the work that I'm doing with our pavilion going forward. Anyway, my point there is that architects need to party more with their clients.
Yeah, true, true. And if they considered the end user to be their clients, maybe that could lead to something too.
Well, that's an entire line there. Like if the, you know, the third client, like it was the state and modernism, this is Rafi Siegel's line, and today it's the market. Like we've reached the point here where like individuals are now the client. Like, and this goes to co-housing, co-living, how we will live together, like beyond market-driven housing, like how do we make the individual that? And that's why I've been really interested in like models like Baugruppen in Berlin, of like where a group of people come together and they crowdfund it, and they are in fact the client. There's no developer. They design their own spaces individually and in tandem. And those are the kinds of things we need. I wish we would have seen that. We didn't see any Baugruppen here.
Not really.
Yeah, we had the Swiss and we had some other stuff. I guess that sort of touches upon it. But yeah, that's my big lament. More practical models of this. I would love to have seen more ideas on the ground, you know, to quote Milton Friedman, you know, in a crisis, the ideas which are adopted are the ones lying on the grounds at the time. And that was neoliberalism in the 70s when the oil crisis has happened. Like now we're at a time of crisis again. Like where are the ideas on the ground? It's some of the co-housing stuff, but I don't know. I guess we got to push it further.
So what's next for us?
Well, tomorrow we're on the train to Turin, headed to Utopian Hours. I think we talked about this last time a bit. We're going to talk about the 1,000-minute city, which I think is really interesting because rejecting this notion of like the 15-minute city Paris model, how do we build a more equitable city for all? So we're going to talk about open collectives there. And yeah, we're going to party more with architects, Dan.
Yeah, I think it'll be pretty outstanding, actually. And I'm kind of liking the idea of, you know, going from Venice, which is, of course, you know, the most GILT city that I've ever seen and possibly in the world has ever known, in terms of accumulated wealth in a tiny little speck of land. And, you know, in the sort of colonial model or the early early form of burger capitalism that extended into colonialism. But then, you know, on the other side, you have Turin, which is sort of like the Cleveland of Italy, like a very much a 19th, early 20th century industrial town that has seen its ups and downs.
Former capital of Italy to you.
Well, that's true. That's true. We researched that, confirmed it.
1861 to 1865. Spooky how it mirrors the American Civil War.
It is actually. But yeah, I think we're a little bit psyched to be going to the site of Lingotto, which is the great factory of the Fiat Corporation that, you know, had the racetrack on the roof, not to put too fine a point on what kind of activities happen there, you know, and has seen a lot of adaptation and resurgence, and you know, it's got some standout projects.
I'm just thrilled to wear my watch on the outside of my sleeve in honor of Gianni Agnelli and the Agnellis there, the Fiat family. It's gonna be great.
That is a very specific and very Greg desire.
That's what I do. I'm just like, when in Turin, you know, pay honor to Gianni. But yeah, this should be fun. All right. So we'll be back, what, episode 3 coming in from Turin?
Yeah, that's what it's looking like.
All right. Let's do it.
Check you then.